Thank you so much. That last one was by special request of me, so thanks for doing that. Thank you. In the spring of 1976, John Updike brought out what was at that time his latest novel. It was titled A Month of Sundays. It was about a minister serving a mainline Protestant church somewhere in the greater Boston area who cracks up in the line of duty. He gets sent off somewhere, New Mexico, Arizona, someplace out in the Southwest, to a facility out there for ministers who, well, crack up in the line of duty. And the structure of the book is the journal that this minister, the Reverend Tom Marshfield, keeps while he is there. Of course, it wouldn't be an Updike novel if the guy hadn't gotten himself into all sorts of sexual peccadilloes, as tend to show up in most of Updike's writings. But mixed in with Reverend Marshfield's sins of the flesh are all kinds of doubts and misgivings he's dealing with about his religious beliefs, his spiritual standing, and all those kinds of things. Not unlike what I was experiencing at the age of 30 when I read the book. The doubts and misgivings, I mean, just to be clear. I was in a bit of a crisis of faith at the time myself. Actually, it was more than a bit. I was wondering if I still even had a career in the ministry, given where my thinking was going at that point. So I devoured this book. And then I sat down at a typewriter. You might remember typewriters. And I whipped off three single-spaced pages of some of the more demented stuff I've ever put on paper. All of it in the form of a letter to John Updike. I've still got the letter. Here's a piece of what I said that I feel okay about reading out loud over 30 years later. How do you know so much about seminaries and seminarians and theology and all of that? What did you do anyhow? Sneak off to a divinity school for a few years and not let your faithful readers know about it? And you might just make a lot of ministers jealous, since you ordinary mortals aren't supposed to be so theologically astute, and you're certainly not supposed to know about the turmoils, anguishes, frustrations, and soul searchings that those ministers with any degree of self-perception experience now and then. Damn it, you're not supposed to know. We're human beings. I actually mailed all that stuff off to Mr. Updike. He was living down in Ipswich, Massachusetts at the time. I was in central Wisconsin as a university campus minister. I was planning a trip to New England a few weeks after all this, and I brazenly asked him if I could stop by his place for a little chat. Now, to tell you the truth, I didn't even expect to get a reply. And yet, about a week or so later, John Updike sent me a postcard, which unfortunately I can't seem to find at the moment, but I know I got it somewhere. I don't mean the postcard because I can remember the text very well. After saying he would be in some other part of the world during the time of my travels, right, so that a visit was out, he added this underlined sentence: "I beg of you, do not give up on the ministry. It needs people like you." Now, to this day, I don't know if he was serious, or if he was just having a little fun with me, or what he was doing with that. I never got a chance to ask him. And since he died several months ago, I guess I never will at this point. However he intended it, though, I took his advice, and here I am, still crazy after all these years. Thank you, Paul Simon. So when I learned then that Mr. Updike had passed away last January, I figured I owed him one. Not that he needs anything from me at this point, if in fact he ever did, but I would like to give him a small tribute, a small eulogy today. I say small since there are year-long American Literature College courses now devoted to his work, so what I can touch on in the next few minutes is going to be rather limited. While Mr. Updike, following his death, was rightly lauded as a major 20th century American novelist, poet, essayist, literary critic, and person of letters. I'm going to treat him mostly this morning as an artist and a theologian. Whether he would want those designations or not, but I don't think he would refuse it. Many of you have heard me say, on other occasions that the task of the artist, and I use that term very broadly, is to allow us to see what has always been right in front of us. We've all seen stars at night. It's Vincent van Gogh and what he could do that showed us the starry night. And John Updike could do with words what artists like Vincent van Gogh could do with their brushes and their canvas. I'm going to offer a passage from his novel, Rabbit Redux. The book's central character and Updike's alter ego, Harry Rabbit Angstrom, is driving into the town of Brewer, Pennsylvania at dawn. Brewer is Updike's fictitious rendition of his hometown of Shillington, Pennsylvania, just west of Philadelphia a little ways, where Updike was born in 1932. Here's the passage. As he takes the road marked Brewer, there's just a lavender touch of light in the air. He comes into Brewer from the south, seeing it in the smoky shadow before dawn as a gradual multiplication of houses among the trees, and then as a treeless waste of industry, shoe factories and knitting mills converted to electronic parts plants and elephantine gas tanks lifting above the trash-filled swampland, yet lower than the blue edge of mountain for whose crest, Brewer, was a warm carpet around a single shade of brick. Above the mountain, stars pale. Take a look at this for a minute. For in the same passage where we see a treeless waste of industry and trash-filled swampland, Updike also shows us a warm carpet woven around a single shade of brick with stars glowing pale just above a mountain. We get a barren and a vacuous, a fallen, if you will, landscape. But still, if you look for it, just enough of a saving grace. The trash-filled swampland is also the warm carpet beneath paling stars. And that's the task of the artist, to show us that little divine spark, that barest touch of the holy, that little bit of saving grace in the midst of the mundane and the fallen. Allen Ginsberg does the same thing in his poem, Sunflower Sutra, where he writes about a battered, beaten down looking sunflower that somehow is still managing to live in the midst of a San Francisco waterfront dump. Well, whether it's Updike or Ginsberg or a visual artist, when they do this, when they give us that glimpse of grace in the midst of the mundane, they are performing a religious act in the best sense of that word. Well, we're staying with Updike. And the underlying theme, one of the underlying themes in much of his writing is the problem or the challenge of belief, particularly for contemporary Americans. Many of his characters are continually reaching beyond themselves for something greater, for some greater meaning, some purpose, some sense of the transcendent, if you will, that they're not getting in their day-to-day lives. I briefly introduced the main character in four of Updike's novels, Harry Rabbit Angstrom. Harry's life, in both a literal and figurative way, actually hits its high point when he's in high school. He's the star of the local basketball team. Memory serves from reading the novels, I think he gets the nickname Rabbit for the way he gets dug around a basketball court. After graduation, he marries his high school sweetheart, Janice Springer. He goes to work for her father at a local car dealership, and he then becomes the manager of Springer Motors when his father-in-law dies and his wife inherits the business. And then his life just kind of goes on from there. In Harry Angstrom, the name, of course, being a play on the word angst, in Harry Angstrom, Updike may have seen the person that he would have been had he stayed in Shillington and followed the life script that he saw was being laid out for many of his boyhood friends. Being blessed with the wonderful literary gifts he had and having courage to pursue them, Updike instead found his road that eventually led him to literary fame and fortune, mostly centered in and around New York and Boston. But he never forgot Harry Angstrom. He never forgot his Harry Angstrom counterpart. In the first of the four Rabbit novels titled Rabbit Run, Harry Angstrom seeks out the counsel of a local minister when his marriage to Janice hits a rough spot. Now, Harry's not a churchgoer, but somehow he befriends a Reverend Eccles, minister at the local Episcopal Church, and they become golf buddies. I rather like this Reverend Eccles character for the way he can combine his pastoral counseling with a few rounds of golf. That's how he apparently operated with Harry. And he and Harry are on their way to a golf course. They're having a conversation about matters of religion, and here's the passage with Rabbit speaking. "Well, I don't know much about this theology, but I'll tell you, I do feel, I guess, that somewhere behind all of this," he gestures outward at the scenery. They are passing the housing development this side of the golf course, half wood, half brick, 1.5 stories, and little bulldozed yards with tricycles and spindly 3-year-old trees. "Somewhere behind all of this, there is something that wants me to find it." Somewhere behind all this, there's something that wants me to find it. In one way or another, many of Updike's characters share that sentiment. They're reaching beyond themselves for something that wants me to find it, as Rabbit puts it. And they really wish they could be believers. Great passage, I've always liked it, in the novel Couples. It takes place in the fictitious North Shore, Massachusetts town of Tarbox. One of the characters is a dentist named Freddie Thorne, and he gets into a conversation with a friend about the biblical story of Jesus changing the water into wine. Here's Freddie's take on that. "Christ, I'd love to believe it. Any of it. Just the littlest bit of it. Just one lousy barrel of water turned into wine. Just half a barrel. A quart. I'll even sell it for a pint. In other words, give me something, anything, to believe in and hold on to." Well, more often than not, when it comes to this reaching beyond that so many of Updike's characters do, they reach for sex. And there's something of an irony in how Updike writes in this vein. If you've read his writings, you know what I mean. He spares very little in the way of language or graphic depictions when it comes to his characters' sexual encounters, but all the while he's being quite the moralist about it. It's as if he is saying to his literary creations, and by extension to his writers, "What you're grasping after isn't really here, but I can still do a heck of a job of describing your graspings nonetheless." No, really, sex and theology seem to be two of his major motifs, and since I said earlier I wanted to treat him as a theologian, I'd better get on with that while I still have the time. I'll lead into this part by noting that Updike could be very biting in the way he treated his characters, but he was never cruel. In reading them, you get a real sense of compassion that he has for the characters he creates, that he really cared for them in the midst of their searchings and their failings and their weaknesses, and their trying again and again to make their lives work in some meaningful way. He had, by extension, a basic compassion for humankind and for the world of human struggles. As for the theologian in him, I often thought that Updike maybe had this image of himself as a theologian acting in the guise of a greatly talented novelist. And this really comes through in his novel, Roger's Version. This is another novel wherein the central character is a minister. Unlike poor Reverend Marshfield in A Month of Sundays, however, Reverend Roger Lambert is a pretty well, Lambert is a pretty well-grounded seminary professor who had been a Methodist minister before he came onto the faculty of a theological school. With respect to his career change from parish ministry to seminary professor, Dr. Lambert says, "I used to be in direct sales, now I'm in quality control." I guess that makes me a lifelong direct sales guy. Anyhow, in this novel, Reverend Dr. Lambert becomes entangled in conversations with a graduate student named Dale from a nearby university, kind of University of Durham's, the seminary campus there. Best way to describe Dale is to say that he's a religious nerd. He is convinced that he has somehow proven, or at least he's convinced that he can prove, the existence of God by means of a computer, or by running all different kinds of formulations through a computer and come up with the existence of God. And he's trying to get a grant from the seminary in order to pursue this project. Now, Professor Lambert's counter-argument is that God is not a construct to be proven or disproven, but an existence or a presence that is either believed in or not, an existence that is either sensed or not, felt or not, known or not. And Roger Lambert's argument with the graduate student essentially is that you cannot, computer or no computer, intellectually construct your way to God or the divine or the holy or whatever you wish to call it. It has to find you. And of course, it wouldn't be an Updike novel without good old Dale getting himself a little thing going with the seminary professor's wife, Mrs. Lambert. But that's just Updike being Updike. You kind of have to humor him when you go through his novels. But getting back to the main theme, Updike was strongly attracted to the work of a mid-20th century German theologian named Karl Barth. B-A-R-T-H, Karl Barth. And he makes his Roger Lambert character an advocate or a mouthpiece for Barth's theology. Barth's basic contention is that God is so wholly other, W-H-O-L-L-Y, so wholly other from humanity that we cannot find God on our own efforts. We have to let God or ultimate reality or ultimate meaning and purpose find us instead. Well, I had to study Dr. Barth during my own seminary days, and I had my problems with the guy, mainly because of the way he tied his theology to a very orthodox version of Christianity. For Barth, God can only find us, or we can only come upon God, through the person of Jesus, and that was where Dr. Barth, for all his esteemed knowledge, lost me. But, with a little help from Updike, I've come to appreciate a more expanded version of Barth's idea. For what Updike seems to be saying to his characters, and by extension to his readers, is to stop trying so desperately hard to find your answers. Try instead opening yourself up more. Open yourself up more to the transcendent, more to the spirit, more to however you name it. And then you may have your moments of grace, your moments of wholeness. They will find you. And I can accept that. I can accept it up to a degree. Because I still enjoy the chase too much to want to stop my explorations, my searches, my probings and pushings for that which is greater than myself. I can't be passive when it comes to the pursuit of the holy. But I also have to acknowledge that there are times when the best thing I can do is to stop and look and listen to whatever the rhythms of life, to whatever the spirit of life is trying to tell me, rather than trying to pull out something on my own. And in those moments, I do discover an appreciation for what Karl Barth and John Updike are saying about letting the sacred or letting the spirit find you. I'm going to begin to wind this down by recalling a line from the Hunter Garcia song we heard a little while ago. Wonderful. You guys did a great job with that. Ripple. There is a road, no simple highway, between the dawn and the dark of night. When I purchased the book, A Long Strange Trip, A History of the Grateful Dead, its author, Dennis McNally, who is a friend of mine, wrote those words next to his signature inside the front cover. I guess he meant I was supposed to heed them. Dennis's father was a Unitarian minister, so he kind of knew where I was coming from, too. I read these words as pointing to a choice we have over the course of our lives, between the dawn and the dark of night, as it were. There's the simple highway. That's the script that some folks assume they're living. And then there's the road you choose to pursue on your own, by following your dreams, your wishes, your personal inclinations. Mr. Updike, as noted, saw in his character of Rabbit Angstrom the simple highway that could have been laid out for him and that he could have traveled, and yet he chose the road of his literary dreams, his own path of the spirit instead. And many of the characters Mr. Updike offers up to his readers and offered up to his readers over the course of his amazing career were men and women who were on the simple highway while also thinking there had to be another road for themselves. They were still looking for ways to meaningfully live in the push and the pull, in the tension between the demands of the simple highway and the promise, the hope, the calling of a greater road. And I think that's where most of us live. Somewhere. We live somewhere between the world we wake up to each morning and the world we envision for ourselves. And that's really not such a bad place to be. If we can learn to live creatively in that space between the road and the simple highway. It's the place where John Updike's characters lived much of their lives. And I think it was his pointed portrayal of people in that place that allowed John Updike to connect with so many contemporary Americans who identified with it. Well, I said at the outset that I connected most strongly with Updike during one of my own crises of faith and belief. And once I got my spiritual ship of state at least reasonably well lighted, found myself in the Unitarian Universalist ministry, I concluded that living religiously is not primarily about having the right, quote-unquote, beliefs up in your head. It's more about how you just do your dance with life. Religion, as Forest Church often reminds us, is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and knowing that we will die. Or to put it less academically and more poetically, religion is about how well we dance along the roads we choose to dance on between the dawn and the dark of night. And when, with Mr. Updike's advice, I did stay in the ministry as a Unitarian Universalist, I discovered, met, and later became very good friends with a poet named Rick Masten, who said just that. Rick said that what we believe is shown forth in the dance we do with life. Rick died almost 1 year ago to this day. I was honored, as many of you know, to be able to get his story into a book while it was still his to tell. He has been much on my mind on this first anniversary of his passing. So even as I honor John Updike's memory this morning, I'm thinking about Rick Masten as well. For in some ways, the legacies of these two are connected. If Updike showed the struggle to find meaning in living, then it was Rick Masten who called us to the dance of life, to the dance of the spirit. So we'll close these thoughts then. We'll sing together Rick's well-known words, hymn number 311, "Let It Be a Dance."